Good morning. I'm Sheila Jasanoff, and it's an honor to be asked to introduce and moderate this first overview session. I was delighted, first of all, to see that the title of this session, or of the conference as a whole, is Opportunities and Challenges. We've heard about risks and benefits. I think it's important to shift the language because risk and benefit are somewhat closed-minded concepts. They lend themselves immediately to economic and numerical analysis, whereas opportunities and challenges suggest something much more open-ended. So I think we've already broached the sense in which the discussion in this room has to be thought about as part of a much more open-ended kind of process. In 1956, the English philosopher W.B. Galley, wrote an article on what he termed essentially contested concepts. He said these were concepts where people kind of agreed on how to judge whether something was good or bad, but would disagree among themselves on whether particular instantiations of that thing were good or bad. And he cited democracy as an example, but he also used the analogy of sports. Now, he wasn't an American, so he didn't talk about baseball. But if you want to understand the concept, you can think about the Red Sox and the Yankees. You know, why? I mean, there are committed fans who would go to the wall defending one team or the other. Obviously, winning strategies cannot be the criterion by which the Red Sox fans decide what their loyalties are. And yet, most people would agree that, by and large, whether a team wins or not should be one of the criteria by which you judge excellence. So, in that sense, I think that what we're talking about today in relation to the opportunities and challenges of synthetic biology suggests that we're talking about essentially contested concepts here, things that are open-ended, things whose value lies in the fact that we continually debate them and not that we get them boxed up and find solutions and make decisions and move onward from there. So one of the sponsors of this meeting is the Royal Society, and next year in 2010, they'll be celebrating their 350th anniversary, so I guess a little bit younger than Harvard University, but, you know, in competition. What should that 350th anniversary be about? Well, the Royal Society's foundation is associated with the Enlightenment. And one way to think about what this meeting is about and what the Royal Society's forthcoming anniversary will be about is that perhaps we're talking about a second Enlightenment. The first Enlightenment took science away from superstition and made it necessary for all of us who live in the modern era to acknowledge that scientific foundation, scientific skepticism, and scientific reason are utterly indispensable parts of our lives. The second Enlightenment, I think, has to do with putting science back into society in meaningful ways. And that's where we get into the essential contestations, because we start talking not about things that are measurable and pin-downable in any sense, but about things that are ongoing and whose very meaning changes. So I think that the kinds of themes that have already been broached and that you'll hear broached more eloquently and pointedly in the two forthcoming talks will be about considerations like imagination, who gets to imagine the future with science and technology, about meaning, what are the institutions with which we assign meaning to innovation, how do we welcome particular innovations into our lives or decide that other ones are not desirable, and also questions of responsibility. So if we're changing the playing field, if we're creating new objects, new ways of going about doing things, then who is responsible for the consequences, whether they're good consequences but need to be distributed or bad consequences that need to be prevented? So if you go back and look at the historical record of Asilomar, which stands the 1975 meeting as one of the milestones in thinking about a new emerging technology, namely recombinant DNA technology, genetic engineering, you will find that people actually didn't think that the release of genetically modified organisms into the environment was something to worry about. So it was put into the class of prohibited experiments at that time. But within 2 years, people were doing just exactly that. So our imaginations are limited, and I think you'll be hearing from our two next speakers ways in which we might be a little more in charge of the process by which imaginative futures enter our lives. So you couldn't have two better speakers than the two we have. The biographies are listed in the papers that you have in your folders, so I'll just very quickly introduce them in order. Drew Endy is assistant professor in the Department of Bioengineering at Stanford University. It's rather sad for me to say Stanford, because until very few months ago, he was down the river, even though I may see him more at Stanford than at MIT. Drew has emerged as one of the most eloquent scientific voices talking about the meaning of the synthetic biology revolution. And following him will be Paul Rabineau, who has already introduced himself from the sidelines. He's director of human practice at the Synthetic Biology Engineering Research Center at Berkeley. And Paul's work has been long identified with meaning-making in the biological sciences. So without further ado, Drew.
It's always surprising to me how hard certain things are to get done, and it makes me very grateful for the process and venue we have today to continue to work together on stuff. I'm going to give an overview on synthetic biology and be pretty direct at the end. The overview, though, is meant to represent and reflect on the great diversity of the field as it's come together over a period of time. So without apology, let me get started. What and why is synthetic biology? Turns out I was able to find a paper with this as a section title. And in reading the paper, four different areas were brought to light: natural science, synthetic science, rewriters, and engineers. And I thought, looking back at this text, there was something missing, humanity, whatever that means, and we'll have to figure it out. So let me talk about these four or five areas quickly. The nature of synthetic biology. We inherit in molecular and cellular biology a tradition of over 70 years, basically having to do with taking things apart, and that's worked pretty well. When you take something apart, a car or a cell, you develop some sort of understanding, an operational understanding perhaps, of that artifact. So for example, in the 1950s, Esther Lederberg and Margaret Leib and others began to notice that bacteria could be infected with viruses. When infected, the bacteria can do different things. Sometimes the bacteria will be destroyed by the virus. Sometimes the virus will go dormant and propagate as a silent messenger within the cell. This has been taken apart for over the better part of half a century, and so you can read books on things like this, the genetic switches that control cell fate outcomes. If you read these books, the high watermarks of much of molecular and cellular biology, they're amazing. They're very, very good descriptions of the componentry within these natural living systems. I first experienced this as a student, and looking back on the books, it turns out I missed some of the most important sentences. For example, in describing how a cell might decide to be destroyed or not by a virus, we find in this wonderful book, The Genetic Switch, we don't know. We do not have a complete understanding of these matters, but we can construct a plausible scenario. In other words, we can tell you a story for how these things might work together. Now, we're familiar with stories from Kipling and other folks, and what we know about the stories is they can be very satisfying, but they don't lead to an operational understanding that would instruct you how you might change things necessarily. It turns out that thus one of the most exciting things for the science of synthetic biology is to take a constructive approach so that we better understand nature, not only taking things apart, but putting them back together and seeing what happens. You get to a different type of understanding as a result. So the work shown here, now a decade old, represents Michael Ellowitz taking the componentry from viruses and bacteria and what have you, reorganizing the proteins that regulate the reading out of genes, and in this case, making a very primitive clock or oscillator that causes a cell to blink. If you follow the movie very quickly, you'll see the cells all blink differently. There's a lot of variation. And what this really leads to is, first, a demonstration of some degree of sufficiency of understanding for how proteins work inside cells and DNA is read out, but then very immediately dramatic attention placed on where does this apparently spontaneous variation come from. And a whole line of research over the last 10 years has picked up to follow this. The synthesis of synthetic biology. So let me move to this tradition quickly. There was an idea a long while ago that mice might come from rags, dirty rags sitting in a corner, sort of spontaneous generation. That's a neat idea, wasn't shown to be true in that case. But wouldn't it be neat if you could take base chemicals, raw chemicals, and somehow have them self-assemble into a reproducing system? Synthetic chemistry applied more and more to the world of life, perhaps making a new type of artificial life. And I'm showing here very early but sophisticated work to make artificial organelles and vesicles that might lead to reproducing systems. Along these lines, unbelievable work coming from Stephen Benner, a synthetic chemist in Florida, who looked at the structure of DNA, which when it was put forward in the 1950s, made it evident to many how this might work as a mechanism for heredity, but then started asking pretty interesting questions. Like, why does DNA have a negative charge along the backbone? That would seem to be a bummer if you're trying to get two things to come together. Opposites attract, not likes attract. It turns out you can answer these questions and begin to develop a much richer understanding of the chemistry of life by simply changing it. So his laboratory, over a period of time working with colleagues in Switzerland, were able to replace the phosphates with dimethylene sulfones, basically making a neutral backbone to the DNA without these negative charges. As it turns out, the resulting molecule does not work as DNA. It collapses upon itself because the negative charges are needed to repel. It doesn't allow the bases to be presented cleanly for interaction, and it doesn't provide a scaffold by which if there's a mutation, you still have effectively the same architecture of the molecule. So all of a sudden, simply by recomposing, if you will, the very base molecules of life, we understand them much more. This leads to outstanding conclusions, such as if you were looking for life on another planet, you might expect to see a polyanion. May not be nucleic acids as we know it, but something that would present this sort of geometry. Liberation of synthetic biology. This is a new idea. It may not be any good. For what it's worth, here you go. The living world that we know exists via this process of direct descent and replication with error. If you're familiar with poetry, the poem from Thomas Hardy about the family face going from generation, leaping over oblivion is the one to look at. This is an amazing process, but from an engineer's perspective, it's an unbelievable constraint and limitation on system architecture. All living things have to be able to reproduce. They have to be able to tolerate or buffer or accept mutations and keep going. You could thus conclude naively, and I mean it naively, that evolution isn't really cool, as much as we might like to celebrate Darwin this year and last, but it's a tyrant that gives us mutation without representation. That's not just a catchy phrase in the context of synthetic biology, because you could take technologies like sequencing of DNA, go from material to information, do some engineering or scientific redesign at the information layer, recompile back down to an object, and off it goes. So all of a sudden now we have an alternative path forward in time for the propagation of living systems, no longer constrained by material replication and direct descent. To put this in context, if you were to take an electrical circuit that had been developed via an evolutionary process, this is the type of architecture humans can find. This is an evolved electrical circuit. It's not designed by a human being. You might ask yourself, what does it do? How does it work? Why does it look this way? The answer is we don't know, to a first approximation. It takes the square root of an input voltage, and what an interesting design. When I show this to electrical engineering colleagues at MIT, they, to a first degree, refuse to consider this system, because it hasn't been designed to be easy for them to understand. They say really intelligent design would have documentation that would help me think about how to explain this to you. What if all of biology is like that? What if we have these evolved systems that internally are oftentimes spaghetti code? Could we reorganize, refactor the architecture of genetic systems, making engineered surrogates that are easier to understand? It turns out that there's the hint of this becoming possible and becoming possible at a much greater scale. And then lastly, looking back 5 years, there's this idea of engineering in synthetic biology. Imagine being a teenager today inheriting a first generation of biotech since recombinant DNA and asking, well, geez, I've got a nanotechnology that actually works. I don't need a national nanotech initiative. I don't need to worry about gray goo. I've got green goo that's already taken over the planet. And I can sort of imagine programming this stuff with genetic material. And oh, it's the stuff of life, which means our entire civilization depends upon it. That's pretty exciting. And it turns out that a lot of people are working on this. So here's a paper that came across the transom yesterday where people have figured out how to program very nice band filters in bacteria. Thus, they automatically control their growth and differentiate, spelling out, hello, hi there. Okay. Thus, we now have in the U.S. and elsewhere new schools of engineering getting started, including biological engineering departments, which basically include the following remit: teach students how to design and build living organisms that work, debug natural write new genetic programs that behave as expected. Lastly, for this part, the humanity of synthetic biology. A lot of people are curious about biology, appropriately so, because it's who we are. It's what we are. Here's a recent photograph from the New York Times. For a different generation, experience with other types of media, I can find entire generations of folks in the U.S. who are more familiar, not with the New York Times, but with South Park and the ideas of polygluteal monkeys. And then, obviously, our hopes and fantasies around making sustainable ecosystems, both on this planet and elsewhere. More practically, we can find, as we work with colleagues across disciplines, a lot of lessons from how technologies develop, impact the environment, and shape our own human environment. Here, a study on the impact of Chicago across the North American continent over a period of time. And thus, it leads to questions I don't know the answers to, but we can at least pose and consider. How will we change ourselves with the next generations of biotechnology in our environments? Should we do it? Can we develop new schools of science and engineering? Could we think about how to integrate things without as much isolation and decoupling from the natural world? Could we invent or understand new modes of humanity involving better representation and access to technologies along with responsibility for our actions? Don't know. To zoom out, then, synthetic biology might be described as learning and playing by making things. And it might also include helping and enabling by building, a scientific and engineering agenda brought together with all of humanity. Of course, it becomes much more interesting to consider the consequences and opportunities, or challenges, if you will, when we recognize that we're talking about a part of the natural world, the living part, which, relatively speaking, we've not yet engaged full-scale engineering and science on. Can we make this easy to engineer? Can we enable humanity? Could we enable all constructive of biotech, not at some arbitrary point at the end of the century, but as soon as possible, and thus better understand nature? How does this map into the big challenges of the day, so to speak? So if you artificially bin our civilization into different areas of work, and open up one of those here in chemicals, you might find things like this. A report from the U.S. Department of Energy, circa 2004. Geez, we'd like to make over 100 chemicals, key feedstocks that our civilization builds other things on from renewable sources, stuff related to industry, transportation, textiles, and so on. We don't have the capacity right now to deliver on this sort of promise, to be frank, and I'll come back to why that might be true. If you open up another one, here a lesson from a colleague at Cambridge University in the UK, say food and agriculture, you could note how long it took us to go from the precursor to corn as we know it today to what we depend on. You could recognize that a very small number of crop species give us most of our calories and proteins. But then when you look at the natural plant world, there are tens of thousands of things we might consider. How important does it become to develop agility and scalability in terms of accessing this, given a world that may be going through significant changes with respect to climate and environment? And then, of course, you have the fantasies of the architects and others, the dreamers, who might be imagining very, very more advanced worlds of biotech, where you could take a gigantic programmable gourd and have it automatically differentiate into a four-bedroom, two-bath. Where are we today? Let me give an example from a friend and colleague, Jay Kiesling at Berkeley. He had the insight to recognize the horror that's malaria across much of the world and that he could do something about it using biotechnology. And so what his team was able to do was spend about $25 million in a research and development process to take genes from plants and elsewhere, put them into E. coli and yeast, and via, of order, a 10-step metabolic engineering process, produce a chemical called artemisinin for treating malaria, instead of producing this chemical by extracting it from the bark of a tree. That took, of order, 150 person years, experts, postdocs, doing the genetic engineering work, and it represents not so much synthetic biology, but the high watermark of metabolic engineering as it's practiced today. Each project, practically speaking, requires a Hercules. Meanwhile, we have resistance to artemisinin developing, which means we probably need to do this project again and again and again. Even if you didn't want 120 chemicals made to have a sustainable white and green chemistry, just for therapeutics, we're just needing to scale. $25 million for each project requires a lot of resources. It requires an incredible fundraiser leader scientist, engineer, project manager, all those skills are rare. Having them in one person is just improbable. So we're not going to do very many projects like this. Meanwhile, human civilization has gotten much better at manipulating the natural world. And so it becomes very exciting in the context of synthetic biology to think about how we might go from found objects like these rocks to standardized objects that come from quarries that let us make more improbable artifacts to synthetic rocks that let us make viaducts such as this one from France and compile cities like Hong Kong in decades as opposed to generations. It lets us go from computers circa 1952 helping to design nuclear weapons to artifacts produced in garages and elsewhere, to personal computers found in pockets all over. Now, when you go buy your mobile phone, you typically think about the applications that it can help you with. I could make a phone call. I could check my email. I could send text messages with photographs on them. You don't think about the tools that led to the transitions that happen over very dramatically short periods of time. So in the case of computing over the last 70 years, you could think about investments in tools like this. Languages and grammars for programming computers. Java, the programming language, was not found growing on a tree. Somebody actually had to pay for that and develop it. Fabrication of silicon wafers represents decades of investment, both public and private. Industries related to electronic design automation, computer-aided design, practically didn't exist in the 1970s. How about biotech then? Well, here's the paper a lot of folks are familiar with, circa 1973, Cohen and Boyer and recombinant production of a plasmid. This leads to the cloning of insulin, the founding of Genentech, and the birth of modern biotech. 12 years later, the early days of Amgen, we have the cloning of erythropoietin and the production of that compound. If you're familiar with bike racing, perhaps not a good thing. And then 3 years ago, the production of artemisinin, the Jay Kiesling project. What's shown below is the methods section of the papers. And we could read them. Let's see. Purification and use of ECOR1 restriction endonuclease, da-da-da-da-da. After converting BST-E2 site into BAMH1 with linker, da-da-da-da-da. It's very hard to read. The big change is that the methods have moved to online supplements, so the text isn't as good. Yes, here we are. The amplified product was cleaved with SPI1 and HIN3 and da-da-da-da-da. That's really weird. Over my entire life, the workflow of genetic engineering has still apparently depended upon experts who have to know a whole bunch of esoteria and manually bash DNA just to produce the artifact to test out to see if it makes the product you want. Wow. How did that happen? Could we make new tools? Well, to wrap up very quickly, I'll give you an introduction to that. I'm sure we'll come back to it. From a policy and practical perspective, one way to filter synthetic biology is to recognize that we use our opposable thumbs to do things, and we make better opposable thumbs. Recombinant DNA, PCR, and sequencing define the last generation of biotech oftentimes. In synthetic biology, we have advanced DNA synthesis techniques. We have abstraction for managing biocomplexity. We have standardization supporting reuse. And these new categories of tools are probably at least as important as what's come over the last 30 years. So that, for example, a metabolic engineering project might not require Hercules and millions of dollars, but teenagers and 5 minutes, who thus could compile an integrated genetic program like this, controlling the odor of E. coli as a function of its growth state. It turns out this is almost true already. It's not a 5-minute project, it's a 10-week project, which means we still have a lot of room to improve. As these tools come online, and I won't highlight the tools, but I'll highlight here the humanity, if you will, the number of people who are attracted to the next generation of biotechnology grows geometrically, is distributed worldwide, and is quite exciting and extraordinary. Students, teenagers, high school students, college students can design and build genetically engineered machines of their own choosing. It leads to many questions, and here I'll wrap up. Should teenagers practice genetic engineering? Not so much as a specific question, but one meant to recognize and evoke issues of safety as we go from one generation to the next in genetic engineering. Should military force include biotechnology? We've lived through the past century where we saw offensive biological weapons programs relatively widely deployed. What happens if this were to happen again? Will biohackers exist? Yes, they probably already do. Will they be good or bad? That depends. Do you choose to acknowledge them or not? Should these components be freely shared or patented or both? Who owns it? Should the public support this research or will private investment take care of it? Should genetic engineers sign their work? Is there a profession here or is it a bunch of scientists, so to speak? How much can we make with biology? I'd love to get Steve Chu to answer this question. It's not clear to me the manufacturing capacity of the living world, and are we going to be in limits or surplus scenarios, in which case land use politics and other things are going to be affected. I'll end with the following pointer. This is not a consensus document, but a colleague, Ed Lazowska, and I attempted to draft some things that might be workable now. And if you're interested in it, you can see arguments for why we might choose to invest in DNA synthesis technology, open libraries of parts, legal frameworks supporting biotech, and integrated strategies for biosecurity, reflecting not only what's happening at nation states, but at the levels of individuals. Thank you again for the venue and future conversations.
I'm tempted to repeat Director Bement's joke and sit down, but I won't. Good. What do I press? Being an anthropologist, I'm not used to PowerPoint. You'll see a few PowerPoints in a second. So two or three quick comments, and then I'll start my talk. As many of you know, in California, we're in a deep fiscal crisis. The governor, as he's affectionately called, is in the process of basically destroying 100 years at the University of California rather than tax automobiles. Had he not rescinded the automobile license fee, there'd be no fiscal crisis in California. So I think this raises the question that is going to circulate around the political economy of what we're doing. In a country with immense resources, how are they being used and distributed? And clearly in California, they're being used extremely poorly. So it's a big crisis point. Second, Pam, skepticism in Greek means inquiry. So probably we're all skeptical. And third, I think that the core problem at one level is the crisis of pedagogy in the American university. I went to a science high school, Stuyvesant, New York, a public high school. I have always enjoyed and liked science. I realized in my honors math class at age 16, I was the only one who had not invented a geometry or an algebra, decided I probably wasn't going to be a mathematician at that point. Then I went to the University of Chicago, which believed you could learn anything and you should. I placed that of all the sciences and decided to do something difficult and went into anthropology. And in France, I'm a philosopher. So there's a lot of reform that's necessary, and I see few signs of it, although actually in the NSF, I've seen much more interesting awareness of this than in certainly the deans and provosts at my distinguished university. Okay, human practices, towards a venue. Let me point out for a start that we're working with a terrific web designer who works at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, Adrian Van Allen. And obviously the Exploratorium is one of the central places in the world where this discussion of how and in what ways a technical scientific knowledge can be used and presented and encouraging people to participate in its use. Adrian's working on two websites for us, the Sinberg website and then this Ars Synthetica, which is associated with Sinberg and in which we're going to attempt to do a good deal of the presentation at various levels of technical interest of what synthetic biology is, what the debates and problems are, and we think we're off to a good start, but give us another few months. And again, thanks to the NSF for funding a lot of this. Okay, off we go. Today, in the wake of the various genome sequencing projects of the 1990s, the life sciences are being redesigned and recast with an eye to productive forms of experimentation and organization. Although varied alternatives on post-genomics are being explored, it is our central working hypothesis that the life sciences, once again, are unsure of their objects, the best venues in which to work on these objects, and the broader ethical framing of their undertakings. If today there is a broad consensus that the genome sequences were not the key to life, but only, quote, the end of the beginning of biology, as Sidney Brenner put it, then it follows logically, at least, that the ELSI programs that were constructed within the political and scientific consensus about the significance of the genome sequencing projects, while continuing to provide useful safeguards and as venues for conducting public conversations, are themselves limited in their scope by their original mandate to operate downstream and outside of the sequencing efforts. Agreeing with Brenner that there is a compelling need for scientists to rethink the understanding of the gene, we argue in a parallel fashion that there is an equally, if not more, compelling need to rethink the ethical framing and metric of ELSI and associated programs, i.e., social consequences. The need for rethinking what is meant by social consequences is actually more compelling, because while it is standard practice, at least in principle in biology, that outdated concepts and experimental techniques will sooner or later be replaced, there is absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that a parallel process exists in the human sciences. It follows logically, although many pragmatic obstacles remain in place before it becomes a reality, that contemporary post-genomic research programs can no longer be constituted as they were in the recent past. In sum, the new arts and technologies of synthesis in biology call for, the invention of new arts and technologies of both analysis and synthesis in the human sciences. Synthetic biology exemplifies an important reassemblage of the life sciences underway today. Its emphasis on instrumental goods, its shift of attention away from the molecule and the gene as primary objects of interest, its attempt to render biology as an engineering discipline, its goal of establishing new collaborative venues for scientific research, as Drew and others have alluded to. Moreover, the conditions and problems under which prior venues, such as Asilomar and ELSI, were constructed, have changed. As such, there can be no simple appeal to prior models or modes of operation. In the very briefest of terms, and we can talk about this, and Sheila has much to say about this as well, globalization has changed the rules of the game. Capitalism has reshaped the infrastructures of scientific research at a global scale. The internet has provided unequal access to materials and scientific knowledge. The political landscape provides a dramatically different ecology of security. All of these yield a dynamic set of emergent interconnections in which older distinctions, such as technology, science, nature, culture, and ethics, politics, can no longer provide a sufficient framing. Now we'll see if I can do this. This is the detailed chart which we've worked out recently from Asilomar to the present, which I'm not going to talk about in my remaining 7 minutes, but I'm happy to discuss this with you in more detail if you're interested. This is a simpler version of it, which goes down the various, there have been a lot that's happened aside from Asilomar and ELSI, particularly in the United States. It would be very interesting to compare this to both England on the one hand and other European and non-European countries on the other. But again, there's not enough time to do this in any detail, although I'll make this available on the Ars Synthetica website, and happy to discuss this with you in more detail. So the three issues that I want to discuss briefly today is the concentration on what kind of venue should the human practices for synthetic biology and perhaps nanotechnology operate within. The question of a venue has not been posed usually in those terms, but I think it's extremely important. So what is the function of the venue? In my opinion, today, the function of the venue for synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and the rest is reconstruction. What is reconstruction? And here I turn to, I actually think, one of the most amazing thinkers in science and technology studies, John Dewey. His essays in Experimental Logic in 1896 and 1912, I think, presages almost all of the advances in the 20th century that have followed it. It has a distinction, however, of being extremely clear and without any jargon. Dewey says, reconstruction, this is from Reconstruction in Philosophy, reconstruction can be nothing less than the work of developing, of forming, of producing, in the literal sense of the word, the intellectual instrumentalities which will progressively direct inquiry, skepticism, into the deeply and inclusively human, humanity. That is to say, moral facts of the present scene and situation. So whatever venues we're going to do, they have to be more than technical, and they have to provide a rather different framing for what the whole enterprise of perhaps a second or third or fourth enlightenment might be about. Now, it may seem like that's a banality, so let me, if I can press this, I'm sorry, I should have had that up on the screen. There we go. It might seem that the function of reconstruction was a banality or self-evident. So here's a list of the other venues which are on the longer chart, what they conceive as their basic function as being, starting with the RAC, audit, advisory functions, and then as we move into the president's commissions and eventually into ELSI, the questions were, since ethical considerations were outside and downstream of the technical and scientific implications, the functions of these venues was diagnosis and implications in a series of them. And then as we come closer to the present, the function becomes monitoring and possibly intervening, and then under the guidance of the Sloan Foundation and NSABB, many of you worked on, formal guidelines, for instance, in terms of regulating synthesis distribution. Again, we can talk about that in more detail if I had more time. Then the metric of what these venues should be guided by. And we think that we're proposing, in any case, that the metric of a new venue for human practices for the emergent biosciences and related other sciences should be flourishing. This time I will remember to put the quote up. Flourishing is a translation of a classical Greek term, eudaimonia, and as such, a range of other possible words could be used. Thriving, the good life, happiness, fulfillment, felicity, abundance, and the like. Above all, eudaimonia should not be confused with technical optimization, as we hold that our capacities are not already known and that we do not understand flourishing to be uncontrolled growth, as we agree with Leon Cass on that, or the undirected maximization of existing capacities for their own sake. The question of what constitutes a good life today and the contribution of the biosciences to that form of life must be vigilantly posed and reposed. Again, then, this might seem like it was somewhat obvious, but going through these other venues in the past, actually, the metric that was guiding their construction and their operation and their principles was quite different. Starting in the Asilomar in the early days, the metric was autonomy. How can the biosciences maintain their autonomy with the least government regulation possible? It shifted slightly later then to questions of values and responsibility. In the ELSI projects, for example. There's a vast philosophic and anthropological critique of values and responsibility. We could talk about that in more detail if we had more time. Then under Leon Cass and the President's Commission, the metric became the truly human, that which could not be violated. And then in more recent days, as many of you in this room know, the metric shifted to security and security and responsibility. None of these per se are illegitimate or uninteresting or unimportant, but we think that they are actually not sufficient given the globalized context that we're talking about and given the potential capacities for synthetic biology and other new biological practices and disciplines to provide a comprehensive metric for where we should be going. Finally, in this series, capacities. this technical distinction we make between metrics and parameters, which if you look on the website, we spell out in some detail. And we think that the parameters that should be paid attention to in a venue guided by a metric of flourishing are capacities. Again, a very quick definition of capacities from my friend Michel Foucault. How can the growth of capacities be disconnected from the intensification of power relations? So this for Foucault is what he calls the paradox of modernity, probably the wrong words, but nonetheless probably the right problem space. I think Drew pointed at this. That is to say, we are unquestionably at a moment in which the capacities of the biological science and perhaps the human sciences and perhaps some of the other industrial organizations of the world are exponentially growing and will continue to grow more and more in the years to come. However, back to the idea of flourishing, how can this growth of capacities be disconnected from massive exploitation and domination and in some way lead to something that not only contributes, but is constituted of the general good? Again, this might seem like common sense, that this would be a goal that might be shared by other venues. But in fact, looking carefully at the series of venues that I just showed you very briefly in the beginning, the parameters that guided them under their different metrics were protection, safety, social consequences, implications, protection, security, and reassurance. None of those are capacity building within an understanding of power and ethics. So we have much to learn from previous venues, but I think we also have much to change from previous venues. So I think the challenge in a radically new context, which is to say not that everything is new, but just that the context and the framing and the challenges are different, is before us. Obviously, there are many people in this room who are thinking and working on this, and extremely grateful to the National Science Foundation for being so far-sighted to include unusual anthropology philosopher skeptics like myself. And we need more of this kind of thinking, more of this kind of practice, and let's get to work.
Thank you, Drew and Paul, for opening up the two words, opportunity and challenge, so elegantly. We have about a bit over 20 minutes for questions. There are microphones on the two sides. May I ask that you introduce yourself very briefly, name and affiliation, and if there's a specific person you want to target your question to, feel free to do that, and make sure that these are questions and brief and not separate lectures. So the mics are open, and I invite you to come. Okay, so let me start on that side.
Yes, François Vaux from the Working Party on Nanotechnology of OECD. My question is for Durandi and for you, Mrs. Chatanoff, and related to concepts and grammars and languages. The problem about languages and grammars is that it can be addressed by the scientific people, but it's also badly needed for the dialogues and public engagements. One of the things we have faced within the OECD Working Party on Nanotechnology is the limit related to organization of knowledge in the field of converging technologies at the nanoscale, synthetic biology being an application of that. And my question is related to this language and grammar concept which has been raised. Would it be something interesting for international cooperation, scientific cooperation, to be done and achieved in the short run around those two concepts? Thank you.
Thank you. Drew.
The words language and grammar bring so much to bear on the world of synthetic biology, both at the technical and scientific level, thinking about how to think about biology. If you could construct a piece of DNA, as we can today, of order 10 million base pairs long, what the heck do you want to say, right? So just within the research community itself, there's a tremendous challenge to invent languages and grammars for describing the living world. So I just want to use your question as an excuse to acknowledge that challenge. The challenge of communicating across factions, parties, peoples, including diverse publics about what's going on came up in the opening remarks and is a tricky one. I had a very enjoyable conversation with Paul Berg last Thursday out at Stanford, and he surprised me by making the suggestion or wondering aloud, perhaps we could do away with the word genetic in talking about genetic engineering, so far as I could figure. And that was sufficiently different from how I had viewed any possibilities that we wondered a lot about that. In my limited experience, when I talk to folks about what I'm doing outside of a laboratory setting, I often observe as soon as I mention the letters DNA, there's a weird glazing in the eye of many of the folks I'm talking with. And it's surprising to me that it's not more exciting and engaging. So this weirdness of opposite expected responses and whether or not that's linked to language, I'm sure it is, leads me with a bunch of puzzles. In very limited experience, what I found to be useful is going to entirely different forms of communication. Felice Frankel and others, for example, have done a tremendous job exploring how image and meaning are related and how you can use visual objects to communicate and represent things in forms that are tremendously more accessible or just different. Paul?
There's a long line, so I'll come back to it.
I'll just add one thing, since you explicitly asked about this, that the problem of language is not only between the scientists and the public, but also that natural languages are different and the same concepts do not mean there's a sort of hegemony of English in the sciences, but there's not the same hegemony of English in fields like law or ethics. And I think there's a great deal more need for comparative understanding of even terms like risk as they're played out in different places. So I hope that your participation through OECD includes that comparative dimension. Yeah, let me go to that side.
Eleanor Powells from the Woodrow Wilson Center. This session opens with...
Can you come a little closer to the mic?
This session opens with thought-provoking reflections on imagination and reinvention. And so I will ask the panelists to use their imagination. And my question is the following. What effect do you envision synthetic biology will have on the socio-technical systems that order human nature relationship? So new ways of understanding new entities and maybe new ways of understanding old ones. So how could we start a discussion, an inclusive discussion with society about a so complex topic using imagination, collective learning? Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, do you want to take that?
It's huge. Maybe we could take a few proceedings with the landscape of messengers a little bit.
Are you both happy with that? Okay, then on this side.
Yeah, I'm Oda. I have quite a straightforward question. Should we abandon the concept of biotechnology and adapt synthetic biology? I mean, that will be simpler and definitely covers what we recognize as biotechnology.
Thank you. And maybe I'll take one more on this side and one more on that side and then come back to you.
Piers Millett, Biological Weapons Convention Implementation Support Unit. Very happy that Asilomar's been mentioned so much this morning. I was a little bit disappointed that Drew didn't use his fantastic photographs from Asilomar, because my question comes down to how do we get back to the point where magazines like Rolling Stone are interested in these sorts of issues, and that the access that sort of interest from popular culture can give to framing the issues like synthetic biology.
Ken?
Yes, Ken Oi from MIT, Engineering Systems and Political Science, and Sinberg. The two speakers did a great job of laying out two sets of issues, and I'm going to push a little bit to bring them together. If we look at Drew and the end of his talk, he raised a number of impending disputes and fights. How do we set protocols and standards? How should we evaluate safety and security? What kinds of activities should take place? What kinds of intellectual property and commons provisions should be made? And then Paul raised a challenge. He noted that we can't turn simply to the past for framing. And at the same time, we recognize that there are antecedents for pieces of the agenda that Drew raised, and that we have a problem with contending bodies of expertise and a need for ways of doing the public deliberation on the tough set of issues that Drew laid out. So the simple question to the panelists and to Sheila: what advice would you offer to us on how to set up or structure public deliberation under conditions of uncertainty, controversy, and claims of expertise?
Thanks. So you can select which ones you want to answer.
Obviously, these are huge. I think the vocabulary and concept questions are important. So one of the first things that I insisted on before accepting to work in Sinberg was that what the NSF wanted was ethics and social consequences. And I said, I don't actually like that. And coined the term human practices. Why? Pretty much everyone would agree that a concept like RNA undergoes evaluation and change and what have you. I don't actually, the concept of society is a 19th century concept. It's the foundations of the 19th century social sciences. It's completely meaningless, in my view, in the 21st century. And therefore, having tried 150 times to get people to stop using society, or at least ask them what they mean by it, and that there's a vast literature in my friend Nicholas Rose in London, myself, many others, questioning what the function of that concept is. So step one might well be that this mutual learning entails mutual learning, and that just as I can't talk about the ether in discussions of physics, people better stop talking about society in discussions, at least in a non-reflective way. And these are where the inequality of power relations come in, at least in this audience and some other audiences. Of course, as Drew indicated, people would hear DNA and go blank. But if you said the deconstruction of society, many people would just nod. That's part of what needs to go on. Yeah, there's more than the two cultures. There are vast divides of resources, power, inequality, knowledge, and the rest. And so having an ELSI model where there's a little bit of humanitarianism thrown in after the fact is really not the way to go. So I'll give one last example on that. We had a conference call at Sinberg a while back, and someone said, is synthetic biology good or bad for humanity? And I said, I can't answer that question. What do you mean by humanity? And they said, everyone knows what humanity is. And I said, it happened to be that a day or two after the Pope and the Vatican had issued a new statement on what humanity was. Well, obviously, I don't agree with the Pope's definition of humanity, and this is a rather old debate and with some new contributions. So, again, this is a plea, particularly also, as Sheila's pointing out, in a global, transnational, multicultural context, that much more attention by all concerned to the exciting changes in biology. And 15 years ago, who knew what interference RNA was? 15 years ago or 15 years from hence, I hope no one will use society anymore.
I could try and get out three things quickly in response to the four questions. Directly, I'd not be in favor of replacing biotechnology with synthetic biology. It pained me to spend time on, I think there's a tremendous scientific contribution from the field of synthetic biology, which stands separate from technology and engineering, and that's great. I'd submit for your consideration words like biologics, drawing from electronics, or biological technology, expanding the word biotech. as a second thought, it strikes me that we've been starting to see our societies, whatever that might be, develop a third perspective on the living world. The first perspective is that the natural living world exists and it does not change, it's static. A second perspective is that the natural living world exists, it changes over time via an evolutionary process. A third emerging perspective is that the natural living world exists, that's great, by the way, we're starting to make our own version of it, and we need to figure out how to take responsibility for that.
One of the core definitions of society is a business association, so I would certainly agree that that's appropriate to biotechnology and synthetic biology, but that's a restricted sense.
So there's this – thank you, Paul. there's this interesting – to me, it seems this third new perspective on the living world means that there's at least two new conversations that we need to have. You can imagine the conversations which take place in this country between the pre- and post-evolutionary perspectives. Now we have a post-synthesis perspective emerging. That means we have to have two additional conversations, the post-synthesis, pre-evolutionary, post-evolutionary, post-synthesis. Figuring out how to popularize that and get that into Rolling Stone, I don't know. Advice on structure of venues and conversations. I think, actually, you brought forward a very a powerful and important point. We shouldn't expect to bundle many of these issues up and be done with them in 1 or 6 months. But given the complexity of the situations and given the ongoing and continued change in the tools, we should expect to have constructive dialogues that sustain themselves for decades, probably, that allow people to return to the issues and change their minds as things progress.
Yeah, just a very small footnote to Ken, since he directly addressed me. I mean, first of all, I'm a lawyer by training, and I feel nervous when people want to read words out of the language, and I'm not quite sure what we'd do if we got rid of genetics and society in the same breath. So lawyers take more pleasure in reconstruing words to suit new factual contexts, and that is also related to Drew's last point about institutions. I guess Dr. Bement has now left the room, but if NSF were to fund a few centers that are really dedicated to the social, political, ethical, and legal studies of science and technology without tying them to particular developments in science and technology, that might be a way to begin in the academic context so that one would have that kind of training and those kinds of development, not as a tail following the dog of the latest best thing in the sciences. So that's one thought. Let me collect a few questions again, starting there.
Yeah, I'm Randy Rutberg at MIT. I'm also the director of iGEM. I'm also an engineer. I'm not a scientist, rather intentionally. I'm an engineer. I'm not an ethicist or an anthropologist. I like to build things. I really enjoy it. I want to have a fun, exciting, adventurous life. I don't want to have a cautious life that is carefully audited, examined, reviewed, measured, and all of that. I think that many people in the rest of society enjoy Red Sox games. And when the Yankees play the Red Sox, they have even more fun. It's hard to see what is the human measure, the human need to do that, but it's very powerful. I remember when I was in high school, I remember sitting in classrooms and listening to reports on the space program. I remember everybody being excited about the space program. I remember sitting around in somebody's apartment the night we landed on the moon. This was something that engaged the interest and enthusiasm of people all over. We have a similar thing we've all shared with the internet and the growth of electronics and computers. So my question is, can synthetic biology be something that is fun, exciting, good, adventurous, that the world can enjoy developing rather than worry about constantly?
Thank you. Paul, did I interpret body language to mean you want to say something immediately?
Okay. There's so many people that...
Yes.
So, yes. Short questions.
I'll try to keep my questions short. Bob McCrate with George Washington University. If today we tried to write the Declaration of Independence, we probably wouldn't hand it off to a university science faculty. And yet Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote it, was both a political scientist and a scientist. Likewise, when J. Robert Oppenheimer worked on the atom bomb, he didn't run around and hold town hall meetings to see whether or not this was a good thing. So what I'm getting at here is the question of how do you ensure public access and public influence and make sure that you create structures that enable that. The second part is in a globalized system like we have here with science with wide open frontiers, how do you homogenize, for want of a better term, how do you homogenize the differences that exist among the different states in reaching what you would call ethical boundaries?
Just let me take two more and then go back to the panel. Yeah.
I'm J.D. Hansen at the International Center for Technology Assessment. One of the things we're quite concerned about is how you have public involved in these conversations, and how we keep from having things sold by hype. One point in my life, I worked for the United Methodist Church, and that helped me understand a lot about ethical language buried in religious language. And what constantly strikes me about the conversation about new technologies is how similar so much of it is to apocalyptic literature, where the promise of the new technology is no child will die before just a few days, every person will live a 100 years, that the new technology will really bring in the new age. And so my question is, how do we have technology funded in a way that doesn't just tap into this is the new Messiah that we need to do this? I've never heard one of the conversations about Artemisian talk about how the Congo has had the worst war since World War II, and that's a large reason for the spread of malaria in this large area. And that's a social issue that requires a different engagement.
Thank you. Yeah.
Political, okay.
And let me take one more on this side.
I'm Mark Bedeau from Reed College and the Initiative for Scientific Social Responsibility in Denmark. And I have a question for Paul Rabinow. The framework that you outlined with the conceptualization of venues and metrics and frames seemed very general and seemed like it would apply to lots of different large issues that confront society, not specifically and especially synthetic biology. And so my question is there something special about synthetic biology that particularly needs or calls for or requires this new way of approaching ELSI studies?
Thank you.
Hi, Mark. Nice to meet him. Mark just edited a book on the ethics of protocells, which I have an essay in, but more interesting essays and a great topic. Two things. The framework is somewhat general for sure, and I think that the synthetic biology is not absolutely unique, and some of the issues with nano are similar, and I have students working with people at ASU, et cetera. That being said, I think what is quite unique about synthetic biology as opposed to nano is really what Drew was outlining for us. This is a construction process, which a project, and what Randy was saying as well, which has a good chance of succeeding, which is already showing that it can do certain kinds of things. But it's quite distinctive in its shift to, again, I just won't repeat Drew's talk, as nano is a technology that applies in 1,000 different places without any great unification to it. Synthetic biology is emerging in a fashion such that to the degree that it succeeds, and that's unpredictable where it'll succeed and how it'll succeed, a particular venue from the start would be appropriate, it seems to me, because of all the construction and production and design questions. So I think design is something that would link everything in Sinberg together if we could make that work. Let me say quickly one other thing. Society, so I say, give my little spiel, and we've heard society again twice. The public is also a meaningless concept. It's an 18th century idea. We could talk about that. There's been vast literature on what publicity means, Habermas and all that. It's generally worn itself out because today it means nothing. So it's the very least plural. So in the UK, which has the most audit society organizations with the various genome and society centers, they, of course, wanted public representation. But, of course, there is no public. So they had to invent one. And as Marilyn Strathern and many others in Britain have shown, if you want to represent the public, you have to identify representatives. There is no amorphous green goo called the public. Their interest groups, their patient groups, their lobbies, their specific political organizations, and the rest. That's very good. Why call that the public? Because that's obfuscating rather than enabling. Then you get into a more technical discussion of who should be represented and how. But then you're more sociological and political than you might be by hand-waving about the public. And then finally, I completely agree with the question of the Congo, the war in the Congo, among others. But the Congo is the most atrocious and genocidal and destructive war, which is barely covered in the press. And, of course, it has massive ecological, environmental, and human consequences, which propagates all kinds of diseases. So, again, one would need to think of a design in which some of this was more integrated from the start.
Drew, would you like to add something?
It's really challenging to figure out how to develop resources without claiming that you're solving a tremendously important problem. And one of the challenges in biotechnology in particular is the humanity of the imaginable solutions of the technology overdrive, in many cases, the investments. So that, for example, if you're working on an artemisinin production problem, not only do you not consider the Congo, you also do not leave behind any legacy engineering infrastructure such that the next time you have to do a sort of biosynthesis project of this form, it's not $25 million, but maybe $2.5 million. That's biotech to a large degree. Meanwhile, we find a funding infrastructure where if you can provide a very simple story for how what you're doing is going to save somebody or benefit a large number of people, it becomes qualitatively easier. So let me acknowledge that from limited experience, I'm sure I'm saying overstating certain things and being naive in other ways, but for what it's worth. Thus, there's a very tremendous challenge within the heart and soul of synthetic biology having to do with figuring out how you advocate for and justify investments in tools independent of any one specific application of those tools. Still working on that. In terms of public access to the technologies, we very naively, in the process by which they're developed, lacking alternatives, started making all sorts of things open as much as possible and having a lot of fun with it. And that's been tremendous. I've now encountered some surprises. So, for example, over the last 12 to 18 months, the emergence of a do-it-yourself biology community, which I am not a part of, in part because it may not be a community, but also because all of a sudden I find myself institutional somehow, and thus not of myself or yourself, whatever that might be. So better work on figuring out how to do that would be tremendous.
So I know there are still some questions, but with this larger group, I'm reluctant to cut any further into our scheduled coffee break. So with apologies to, well, isn't, are you waiting to ask a question?
Yes.
Well, okay, so.
Okay, very brief. I'm very happy to have seen your confidence. I call it a professional confidence or scientific confidence. I appreciate it. But what I'm concerned is whether what has happened to GM would also happen to synthetic biology. It would be partially rejected or refused by some of the public or in some of the countries. What should we do when we talk about science before it is too late?
We could talk about it. You know, to be specific, almost every year somebody makes a very good argument that the field of synthetic biology should be renamed. At the Synthetic Biology 2.0 conference in Berkeley, a proposal was semi-jokingly put forward to rename it Shiny Happy Biology. Perhaps that would make it more acceptable. the counter arguments, which continue to hold the day, is that there are things to have fun with, there are things to worry about, and it would be disingenuous, if not dangerous, to disallow fun, but also to ignore things that need to be discussed. And to the extent that the word triggers a little bit of a response more broadly, might help to ensure that we have sustainable conversations.
I think we also need to explore what the GMO controversy was, how it began, and then how it's changed, and where it's changed, which is not is not the same as, you know, everywhere. It's particularly acute in Europe, but much less so here, whereas abortion and stem cells much more acute here and much less acute in Europe and many, and in China, I don't know. I'd be very interested to hear more about that. So just final provocative comment. This is a challenge for Enlightenment thought of promoting the worth and value of science, because there's tremendous fear of science, and that is not just the Enlightenment view that superstition and ignorance reign, which they do, Michael Jackson, Sarah Palin, and the rest, but there's a lot of work to be done on that, so that, for instance, in the UK and in Europe or Germany, tremendous resistance to GMOs and whatever on the one hand. On the other hand, the new cuisine, which is embraced by the elite in all of these countries, and coming from Berkeley, I know what it is. So when Alice Waters grows X varieties of arugula in the Sierras, that says unnatural genetically modified organisms as have ever existed in the universe. But since it's not done scientifically, it's acceptable. So there's a very strange paradox that people eat arugula grown in the Sierra Mountains, foothills of the Sierra Mountains, because no one knows what's going on with those genomes. But if you do know what's going on with the genomes, or begin to know what's going on with the genomes, then people are afraid. This is profoundly troubling to me as someone who's extremely pro-Enlightenment and pro-science. But I think the diagnosis of that type of problem is something we all need to spend more time paying attention to.
Well, that's a sufficiently provocative note to end on. So would you please join me in thanking the panel and the questioners.